Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How can densely populated urban areas take advantage of the hunger for locally grown produce? At first glance, it would seem impossible to raise a substantial amount of food in places where buildings and pavement have a vastly larger footprint than green space. But some pioneering growers are making innovative use of the largely ignored square footage at the top of buildings to cultivate everything from herbs, vegetables, and fruits to even bee colonies and chickens. Landscape architect Lauren Mandel has been studying and working in the field for several years as a project manager and as a rooftop agriculture specialist. Her new book is called Eat Up, The Inside Scoop on Rooftop Agriculture. Lauren, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. It's a pleasure to be here.
So this all feels very new and hip and modern, but you remind us that rooftop agriculture has been around at least since the Hanging Gardens of Babylon.
It's true. Some historians do think that the earliest record of rooftop agriculture was at the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, which is present-day Iraq, in around 600 BCE.
And how did rooftop agriculture start to emerge as an American trend in the 20th and 21st centuries?
Sure. So it really started to happen in the 1990s. There were a couple instances of relatively experimental rooftop farms and rooftop vegetable gardens around North America beginning at that time. And then in the past, I would say 3 to even maybe 5 years, it's really started to take off as people have an increasing interest in growing food locally in places where there's not a lot of space on the ground.
And the people who are most interested in it these days are actually young urbanites in their 20s.
That's true. A lot of the rooftop farms out there were founded and are run by folks who are in their late 20s, early 30s. Although when you take a look, when you sort of step back and you take a look at rooftop gardening in addition to rooftop farming, you see that people of all different ages and all different backgrounds are actually participating in this movement.
How variable are the startup costs for undertaking a project like this? You look at sort of small scale, medium scale, and large scale rooftop agriculture here.
That's a great question. The price can really vary significantly for these projects. If you're talking about small-scale production, so just rooftop gardening, maybe on your own roof or on the roof of your apartment building, the cost can be pretty low. It can be comparable to buying just a couple of pots and growing something on your back porch or your backyard, for example. When you start to get into rooftop farming, which brings into consideration the commercial aspects of production, the prices can range from about $10 a square foot for an inexpensive rooftop row farm to upwards of $70 a square foot for a hydroponic greenhouse.
So now hydroponics have sort of pros and cons, as does row farming, and then there's container farming. Can you take us through those in terms of overall cost and weight and the amount of effort required to grow food in each of these ways?
Sure. So the way that I like to look at it is that all of these types of production, so like you said, container gardening, raised bed production, row farming, and hydroponic greenhouses, people choose to deploy these strategies for all different reasons in order to fulfill all different kinds of objectives. So everything from rooftop farms and gardens that have a community emphasis, all the way up to rooftop farms and gardens that are really targeted at growing as much food as possible in a small amount of space and making money. So rooftop gardening in containers allows people the flexibility to try growing their own food in a really flexible way. So you can have, you know, anything from a couple of tomato plants in containers to an herb garden maybe, or something a little more adventurous. And you can sort of place these containers in a pretty flexible way around the space that you have. And you can get, you know, fairly low yields, but it provides a really great educational experience, especially for kids. It provides a way for folks to grow their own fresh food at home. And so there's a lot of sort of personal benefits to small-scale rooftop gardening in containers. When you get up to gardening and farming and raised beds, your yields increase. The weight of the operation may also increase. And you have to pay a little more attention to things like how does your irrigation system hook up, where are you placing the raised beds around your roof, and how much do they actually weigh? And so, you know, you have to, the considerations just change a little bit. When you get up to rooftop row farming, your yields can be a lot higher than with raised beds, Your weight also increases, so you have to make sure that you're doing everything in harmony with the structural capacity of your building. And you have to really start to consider the commercial aspects, the marketing aspects, the long-term planning aspects of your project. And then when you get up to hydroponics, which has the highest yield for the smallest amount of space, I would say that the pros are, you know, your overall yields, and also that you can grow year-round, even in places as cold as Canada. But one of the cons would be the upfront investment.
So, you know, you stress here that for anything more than, you know, tomatoes in a pot or something, or some herbs, you really need to consult with a structural engineer to make sure that you have the right setup, that the roof is strong enough to hold what you want to do. How often are existing roof spaces suitable for any of the three sort of somewhat larger kinds of operations that you've described?
Right. So consulting a structural engineer is certainly one of the very first things that you do want to do when pursuing any kind of large-scale project or medium-scale project, like you said. The structural capacity of the building depends on several factors, one of which is the age of the building and the type of the building. So in different cities, during different time periods, building codes specify that the roofs had to be a specific strength. Buildings that are built these days are usually a little bit weaker in the roof than older buildings. And so if you're out there and you're scouting out a place for your rooftop farm, a good place to start looking is for buildings that were built right after the turn of the century. Big warehouse structures are usually pretty beefy and can support a lot of weight. Also, sometimes buildings were built with the initial intent of building additional stories on top of the lower stories, and those additional stories were never built. And so these are oftentimes also a good bet to ask your structural engineer to take a look at.
And, of course, you want to look at a space that has some kind of a lip so that you're not going to accidentally tumble over the edge.
Exactly. That's very important also. Personal safety is very, very important. So the lip that goes around the edge of the building is called a parapet by architects, and this is a sort of a wall-like structure that surrounds the outside of the building. And the building code will actually specify how tall this parapet has to be within the city that your building is in. And if you don't have a parapet that's tall enough, you need to start thinking about things like adding railings, which can be quite expensive, actually. So you need to make sure you have the budget in place for something like that.
How amenable are building owners to one of their tenants saying, hey, I've got this crazy idea?
That is a great question. And I think there is a wide range in responses. Building owners in places like Brooklyn, for example, which is a real hot spot for rooftop agriculture right now in North America, are becoming increasingly interested in accepting a wacky proposal like putting a farm on their roof. I think that, you know, the more a building owner has heard about something like this before and heard about other building owners taking this on, the more likely they are to consider it for their own property.
So do most people start sort of small and experiment and get a feel for the ways that rooftop agriculture is different from conventional agriculture and then scale up?
Some people do. You see a lot of home gardeners start with containers, with just a few containers, and they start to build from there and expand their garden areas. When you get into the commercial end of things, though, a lot of times you see rooftop farmers approaching roofs from, you know, with a rural background. So they started out farming out in the country, and they decided that they want to move back to the city or something like that. They want to start a rooftop farm closer to where more people live. Other folks, though, who decide to start their own rooftop farm are not growers at all. They're actually CEOs, businessmen, entrepreneurs, even restaurateurs. So people are really approaching rooftop agriculture from all different backgrounds and all different perspectives, which makes this movement really interesting and diverse.
So, Lauren, obviously people, I should say obviously, maybe I'm wrong, but I wouldn't think that people are dragging, you know, tractors and things like that up on top of roofs. So in terms of labor costs and the amount of human labor that goes into this, how does rooftop agriculture compare with something that takes place in a field?
That's a really great question. Usually these rooftop farms, if you're talking about a soil-based system, use a lot of labor. So a lot of these farms have not only a farmer and apprentices and interns, but a lot of them also utilize volunteer labor. And this can be a tricky thing. For anyone who's worked with volunteers, it takes a lot of time to coordinate volunteer efforts. And then if you have new volunteers every single time, you're training new people every time you're out there. So that can be a real sink on resources. The best kind of volunteers are repeat volunteers. Mm-hmm. And there are plenty of these out there. So people who take an interest in rooftop farming and choose to come back maybe once a week or once a month. And when they get there, they really know the drill. When you're talking about hydroponics, it actually takes very few people to grow the food for a wide group of eaters. So hydroponics is an interesting model to look at. Usually the people who work in hydroponic rooftop farms are very highly educated. Sometimes they have engineering backgrounds or something like that, and they're able to grow a lot of food with only a few hands.
So hydroponics is using liquid nutrients as a growth medium rather than soil. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay. So what is the advantage of putting something like that up at the top of a building instead of in a freestanding space? Is it simply that the land is already bought and paid for?
Yes, it could be that the land is already bought and paid for. It could be in the case of a Whole Foods, which is under construction right now in Brooklyn, they want to grow their own food and they don't have any space. And so they're actually in the process of installing a hydroponic greenhouse right on top of the Whole Foods. And it's run by a company called Gotham Green, mm-hmm. which has a history of selling rooftop produce to Whole Foods already and other high-end markets. And so, someone might choose to pursue this route because they already own the roof, because they don't have the land next to it, or, to be honest, because of the marketing potential.
So obviously, you want your roof to be watertight regardless of what's going on up there, even if nothing's taking place. But I wonder about the special considerations that you have to take into account when you will be adding some kind of irrigation system.
Right. Now, that's a really great point. So what some people, I'm sure some building owners know this, but people who don't own buildings may not realize that most flat roofed buildings have a waterproofing membrane on top of them that is under warranty by the waterproofing provider. And so when you propose to put something like a green roof or a rooftop farm or something else on top of that membrane, the waterproofing membrane provider needs to know what's going on, and you need to make sure that you're designing it in a way that they will not void the warranty because of what you're doing. So the company that I work for, which is called Roof Meadow, we design green roofs around the country. One of the things that we do is we work very closely with the waterproofing provider to make sure that there's a lot of communication before anything gets built so that everyone knows what's going on and we can coordinate properly on how to maintain that warranty.
How common is it for these waterproofing providers to sort of understand exactly what you're talking about on the first phone call? And are there a number of them that really have not had experience with this sort of thing and maybe wouldn't be the companies you'd want to move forward with?
So at this point in time, most of the waterproofing companies know about green roofs and they're very familiar with them and comfortable with them. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they want you to use their own green roofing system, so they've developed sort of an offshoot of their waterproofing company to manufacture materials or resell materials for green roofs. And then others are more flexible in letting you grow or put whatever you need to put on top of their membrane.
Lauren Mendel is with us. She's a landscape architect, project manager, and rooftop agriculture specialist. She's got a new book out called Eat Up, The Inside Scoop on Rooftop Agriculture. If you've got a question about this or want to share your experiences, we'd love to hear from you now at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with landscape architect Lauren Mandel. She's a project manager and rooftop agriculture specialist, and she's author of the new book Eat Up, The Inside Scoop on Rooftop Agriculture. You can be part of the conversation at KERA.org. That is think at KERA.org. Or you can call 1-800-933-5372. Okay, so Lauren, anyone here in Texas who has had to get up on the roof at midday to cut down a tree branch or deal with a leak or something understands it feels much hotter there than it does on the ground. And you talk about the importance of understanding the microclimate that might exist at the top of a building that is different from what's happening on the surface of the earth.
Yes, that's right. I spend a lot of time up on rooftops for my job, and I'm always surprised every single time at the difference in temperature, the difference in wind speed, and other environmental factors that occur on a roof as compared to the ground. So when you're thinking about growing food on your rooftop, you want to be really cognizant of what the conditions are actually like up there. Not what you think they're like, but what they're actually like. So what I tell people is to go up to your roof not just once, but two or three times during different times of day, different seasons even, to see what the wind speeds are like and how cold it might be and how hospitable an environment it is for plants. Hmm.
And then just choose plants accordingly or decide maybe this is not the building to try those?
Well, if you have the flexibility to be particular about your building, so let's say that you're looking to sign a rooftop lease instead of growing food on your own roof, then yes, it's a great idea to find the building that makes growing the easiest it can possibly be, because growing food on a roof has its own set of challenges, and you want to make sure that the conditions that you're setting for yourself are as favorable as possible.
What do we need to think about with regard to using, say, chemical fertilizers or pesticides? I know many people want to get away from these, but they are a fact of life for some agriculture. When you're applying those in a building that is inhabited by humans down below?
It's interesting because a lot of the rooftop agriculture that's conducted in North America is actually it's grown not necessarily certified organically, but a lot of people are not using these chemical fertilizers, pesticides, and herbicides. There are a couple instances of certified organic rooftop farms, such as a place called Uncommon Ground, which is in Chicago. It's the rooftop of a restaurant and actually the first certified organic rooftop farm in the country. But the main reason why people aren't using these chemicals is because they're in close proximity to other people, like you said, but also because they're growing usually a wide variety of crops. So a lot of times when you get into problems with insects attacking your crops or things like that, it's because you're growing a lot of the same thing. And so those insects come and, you know, let's say they're really interested in, I don't know, eggplant. They're going to come and they're going to grow a taste for eggplant and they're going to eat your whole crop and devastate everything. When you get into polyculture, when you get into growing a wide variety of different crops, you may have an eggplant pest, but it'll affect your eggplant, but not the other plants that are there. So when you're growing food in cities on rooftops, a lot of people are interested in growing as much diversity as they possibly can, which is very beneficial when you're talking about chemical usage.
One other thing I want to ask you about the microclimate is that if you're in an urban environment, this is something that we've actually had an issue with here in North Texas, the buildings around you can reflect light in different ways that you might not expect. Can you talk about light conditions a little bit?
Yes, absolutely. And we've actually encountered this at my office when we were designing green roofs. Is that, there's one particular instance I can think of when we were designing a green roof in basically an internal courtyard for a building. Mm-hmm. So an area of the building that's elevated, but it's surrounded by taller building stories that all were faced with windows with glass. And, we figured that this was going to be a pretty shady area because it's surrounded by taller building stories. We planted all shade-tolerant plants, and before we knew it, everything had fried because all the light was reflecting off those windows into the courtyard and heating up the whole environment. And so when you are thinking about growing food on your roof, you need to be very cognizant of what's going on around those crops. So what's going on with maybe taller stories of your own building, what's going on with adjacent buildings, and what's going on in vacant lots around your building where taller buildings could be built.
And what's the effect of having a green roof or rooftop agriculture on conditions within the building, how hot or cold it gets, how much insulation you need, that sort of thing?
So when you have a soil-based system on your roof, like a green roof or a rooftop soil-based farm, the temperature within the building can be moderated if that building is 1 to 2 stories. So what affects indoor climate with regards to the rooftop treatment is really a function of the size of the building roof relative to the volume of the building itself. Mm-hmm. So what I mean by that is that if you have a wide, low building, like a big box store, a Walmart, for example, and you put a green roof on top, you will notice effects of a moderated climate inside the building. You may even notice energy savings from your utility bills, both in the summer and in the winter. But when you get to a taller building, like a skyscraper or a 12-story building, say, with a small rooftop, you really aren't going to see that many internal building benefits.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go first on the phone here to Max in Duncanville. Hi, Max.
Hello. I was wondering about the difference between using natural, organic, full of micronutrient soil to grow your vegetables in versus hydroponics, which I assume would be just a few basic chemicals. Are they nutritionally the same?
Thanks for your call.
Thank you. That's a great question. So high-end hydroponic operations spend a great deal of time figuring out exactly which nutrients and how much of those nutrients need to go into the nutrient solution to feed the vegetables. There are some purists who think that there's no way to replicate soil-based farming, and they think that there are more nutrients in soil-based plants that are grown in soil-based agriculture and that they taste better. But the hydroponic folks have a pretty good handle on it, and they would say that the vegetables grown hydroponically taste just as good and are just as rich in nutrients. So what I like to tell people is if you have the opportunity, try to conduct your own taste test and buy a tomato that's grown in a conventional farm and a tomato that's grown in hydroponically and see what you think.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Let's go next on the phone to Jim in Louisville. Hey, Jim.
Hi. I'm interested in the physical structure of a rooftop garden. Specifically, is it in a box elevated above the surface of the roof? And if so, what's the proper drainage mechanism? And does the water actually drain onto the surface of the roof? Because if so, I could see a lot of problems in certain types of roofing materials that would not be conducive to staying wet all the time.
Thanks for your call.
That's a great question. When you're talking about raised beds, such as a raised bed that lays low to the ground, what some people do is they actually will throw their raised bed on top of some kind of drainage layer. And that drainage layer may be a green roofing material, such as a rigid plastic sheet drain, which is sort of shaped like an egg crate that promotes drainage and keeps the soil directly off the membrane. And you'd have a protection layer of fabric and also possibly a protection layer made out of polyethylene underneath that to protect the waterproofing membrane. There's a rooftop farm in Portland, Oregon that has their raised beds installed on top of rubber walk pads that allow for drainage to occur through them. When you start to get into raised beds that are elevated off the roof deck, I've seen people deploy several different strategies for what to do with the drainage. So sometimes the beds will drain to a certain location within the bed, and then the water will be directed through some kind of pipe or tubing towards the roof drain itself, and sometimes the water will drain more freely. In general, I wouldn't be too concerned about water on the membrane because any waterproofing membrane is going to be used to that anyway. What you do want to avoid is pooling on the membrane because that's indicative of a poor drainage.
Is there a way to capture and sort of store rainwater that may not fall directly onto your beds but might be of use 2 weeks later when there's been no rain?
Sure, and architects are interested in that, very interested in rainwater harvesting in that way. You have to take a very close look at the local building codes because mm-hmm. in certain cities they actually specify that if there's rainwater that hits a bare membrane roof surface, drains off of the roof, you can use that water, you can collect that water, and you can water ornamental plants, but you are not allowed to water crops with that people are going to eat, or crops that in particular you're going to sell for people to eat. Hmm. And so what one strategy might be is to collect the water that maybe drains through the farm, or maybe it drains through a regular green roof area, a thin green roof area that's next to the farm. You might be able to collect that and use that for irrigation.
So the concern, I guess, would be in cities that restrict this, that water that is that's drained through conventional roof materials might have sort of run through that layer of petroleum-based roofing materials, that sort of thing, and have become contaminated?
Exactly. That's the concern, particularly for older waterproofing membranes, so membranes that have been out there for a while in the sun and in the freeze-thaw cycle, maybe not as much in Texas, but in other places. And they've started to degrade over time, and so there's a concern that there can be specific contaminants that leach out of that membrane or wash off of that membrane into the water.
Yeah. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Calvin in Fort Worth. Hi, Calvin.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Love the show. I wanted to ask the author if she's evaluated the use of aquaponics instead of hydroponics and bringing the nutrients from the nitrogen cycle instead of these artificially produced nutrients that are used traditionally in hydroponics.
You know, that's a great question. This is such an exciting time for aquaponics right now. I just hear more and more stories of successful aquaponic operations hopping up left and right. And for the listeners who aren't familiar with aquaponics, this is a closed-loop system that involves growing fish, actually, in containers of water. And the water is cycled from the fish tanks or the fish basins into an area where vegetables are grown. And so the fish effluent actually fertilizes the plants, and the plants then filter the water, which is pumped back to the fish. So the water just goes around and around, and the result is vegetable crops and also fish that you can eat. And so this is something that seems to be very popular in warehouse spaces, within buildings, in basements, even sometimes in greenhouses. I have not seen very many examples of aquaponics on rooftops in North America yet, but I have a feeling that people are going to start experimenting with this. The biggest challenge will be the weight of the water.
Hmm. Is there a limit to the size of the plant? Like, you don't want to do an orchard on the top of a roof, I would imagine.
There are some rooftop farms out there that are growing fruit trees. There's a really interesting rooftop farm on top of a hotel in Vancouver, British Columbia, and they grow, they have fig trees, they grow all kinds of berries, even gooseberries, really interesting crops. But in terms of height, yes, you're right. Since the wind is more severe on top of a roof, trees can be fairly challenging to grow successfully. And so, you know, we design green roofs that have trees on them from time to time, but it's harder the taller the building is because the wind becomes more severe. In terms of more typical crops, the lower stature crops do tend to be a little more successful because staking plants on a rooftop farm can be a little bit tricky, especially when you have to be careful not to damage the waterproofing membrane by sticking in some kind of stake into the farm.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Andrew in Dallas. Hi, Andrew.
Hello. I have two questions. One is anybody doing terraced roof gardening for slanted roofs, and how's that working out? And the second is bricks testing, refractory testing for the quality of plants you're getting off the rooftop, whether you're using aqua, hydro, or standard soil. Is that useful, or is it not particularly useful?
Thanks for your call.
Mm-hmm.
Lauren,
so,
any thoughts?
Yeah, so terraced farming on sloped roofs, I haven't actually seen any examples of this in modern times, but I don't see why it would be a problem. I think that there are strategies that could certainly accommodate this kind of production. I think the tricky thing about it would be that the soil would be deeper towards the edges of the bed and a lot shallower as the slope starts to increase for each tier. But I think that it's most certainly doable. And we certainly design regular green roofs for roofs that have all different kinds of extreme slopes. It just becomes a little more tricky and you need a little bit more engineering, but it's certainly possible. And the second question, I was actually having a little bit of trouble hearing what he was saying.
He's not on the line anymore, but I think he was saying BRICS testing, and I'm not sure what that refers to.
BRICS testing, I'm not familiar with that term, actually.
Okay.
And I should say my background is not, I'm not a farmer, I'm a landscape architect, so I'm still learning some of these terms myself.
Well, talk about this. There is the idea that you can sort of grow your own things. There are some cities, though, that make this harder than others. What kinds of restrictions have people faced, and what are the best ways around those?
Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you're talking about, say, rooftop greenhouses, one of the restrictions that a lot of people have encountered in cities is that if you want to build a permanent greenhouse structure on top of your building, that actually counts as an additional building story. And so depending on how your neighborhood is zoned, you may actually not be able to do that. You may require some kind of variance in order to get around the building code.
Mm-hmm.
So what some cities have done, like New York City, which I believe was the first, at least the first that I know of, is that they decided to amend their building code to state that if you have a greenhouse, a permanent greenhouse structure on your roof and it's used to grow food, that does not count as an additional building story.
Hmm.
And that is a huge, huge deal for rooftop farmers in New York. That's a really big deal. And this is a perfect example of how policymakers, when they're aware that there's a need for a certain kind of change, can really be influential in forwarding a movement in a particular city.
Lauren Mendel is with us. She's a landscape architect, project manager, and rooftop agriculture specialist. Her new book is called Eat Up, The Inside Scoop on Rooftop Agriculture. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Lauren Mendel, whose new book is called Eat Up, The Inside Scoop on Rooftop Agriculture. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org. Lauren, I'd like to talk for just a minute about dollars and cents. First, there's the question of energy intensity and what it takes to grow crops on the roof as opposed to at the ground level. And dollar for dollar, do you get fewer pounds of food for your money when you're buying rooftop produce?
So some rooftop produce is more expensive than ground level produce just because of the added effort that it takes to grow food on rooftops in challenging rooftop environments. I think that the price for rooftop crops may go down over time a little bit as rooftop row farmers get a better hang of how to grow things as efficiently and effectively as possible. If you're talking about rooftop hydroponics, though, the prices are fairly competitive, and the amount of produce that they can grow in these farms is pretty astounding. And there's a statistic in my book which comes from an interview with one of the rooftop CEOs of a hydroponic operation that says that rooftop hydroponic farms can grow 20 to 30 times the yield of a traditional ground level farm while using 20 times less water.
Wow.
A really astounding fact.
Is the expectation that all your materials need to be replaced about as often as you would have to put a new roof on a traditional building?
Ah, well, so this is the great thing, is that when you put something like a green roof or a rooftop farm on top of your building, the waterproofing membrane itself can last 2 to 3 times longer. And this is because in places that have varying climates where it gets pretty cold, so not as much Texas, but more, you know, the Northeast where I live in Philadelphia, and the whole northern part of the country, really, is that a waterproofing membrane will degrade over time because of UV rays, which you would, of course, have in places like Texas, but also the freeze-thaw cycle does tend to disrupt a membrane over time. So when you put some kind of system on top of your membrane that holds water, so a saturated system or a system that is partially wet a lot of the time, it actually stabilizes the temperature that's directly on top of the waterproofing membrane and helps to prevent that freeze-thaw cycle from happening so frequently. Hmm. And it also blocks UV rays from hitting the membrane.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Kirk in Dallas. Hi, Kirk.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was wondering if seed producers are starting to breed varieties that have the characteristics that do better on rooftop farming, and I'll take my answer on the air. Thanks.
Thanks for your call.
You know, I was having dinner with my dad last night, and he asked me that very same question. He thought I should go into business breeding those specific types of crops. So that's really funny. There is no one that I know of that is growing these types of rooftop-specific crops at this time. Characteristics that you would want to look for in a rooftop crop would be low stature, ability to tolerate periods of relative drought, although these systems are always irrigated, but they may be a little bit drier on the roof than they would be on the ground. I would say that those are really the main characteristics that you would look for. Growers out there that are doing commercial production on roofs have been telling me that they've had a lot of luck with hot peppers. That seems to be one of the most durable rooftop crops. And so I wouldn't be surprised if they themselves are experimenting with which specific cultivars of hot peppers are most successful and why.
Any concerns about sort of the height? Is there a point at which buildings are too high to sustain a rooftop agriculture operation?
Well, you know, the higher you go, the more severe the conditions can be in terms of microclimate. But there is one rooftop farm in Brooklyn that I don't know actually the exact number of stories up, but I think it's around 8 stories above the ground. And this is a pretty large commercial farm that's doing reasonably well. And so I think that, you know, it's more risky when you get to a building that's that high. But if you really know what you're doing, and perhaps there are even some taller levels of the building that are blocking the direction that the wind comes from, you may be okay. Mm-hmm. But I always tell my clients that the lower the building, the better. Mm-hmm. So the best buildings to look for are 1 to 2 stories. Preferably, they'd be situated not directly on a body of water. So if you have a building that's right next to a river or, you know, a large lake or something like that, you may have a bit of a lake effect where you've got a lot of wind coming off that body of water, which can make things a lot more challenging.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Ed on the line now in Dallas. Hi, Ed.
Hi. I was wondering if your guest was familiar with the exhibit at Epcot called The Land, where they demonstrate aquaponics and hydroponics and other novel techniques for farming.
Have you seen that, Lauren?
No, I'm actually not familiar with that exhibit. It sounds very interesting. And I can understand why they've decided to pursue an exhibit like that, because there are a lot of folks around the world right now who are experimenting with all different methods of vertical agriculture. Some things people have heard of, and other things are pretty new, wild ideas that maybe may have just been developed.
Is the environment of working on a rooftop farm does it compare with sort of feeling like you're in the great outdoors working on a conventional ground level farm?
Well, it's different. I'll tell you, the views are a lot better. So, you know, I've worked on rural farms a little bit when I was younger, and You know, it can be a very serene environment if you're on a sort of a small-scale mom-and-pop organic farm. I would imagine it's a little bit less serene if you're working on a large-scale conventional farm. When you are in a city on a rooftop, you're very much aware that you're on a rooftop. So even if you are working on a large-scale rooftop row farm, for example, you always see that skyline in the distance. And you're always cognizant of the fact that there's a parapet around the farm and that there's mechanical equipment dotted throughout the tomato plants. And there's, you know, a head house with a door or an elevator or something like that that's next to the cucumbers. And so it's a little surreal. And there are definitely elements of it that are reminiscent of a rural setting, but it's pretty unique at the same time.
Back to the phones now. This time we have Nicholas on the line in Dallas. Hi, Nicholas.
Hi, how's it going?
Great, thank you.
Thanks. So my question is what are the logistics of moving that much material onto the top of a roof that's maybe a couple of stories tall? Are we just using elevators or cranes?
Oh, that's interesting.
Right, and that's something that a lot of folks don't think about, so I'm really glad that you asked that question. It depends a little bit on the scale of the operation. If it's small enough and budgets are really tight, sometimes clients will try to move the soil and other materials through the building themselves or with a small labor force. But on larger projects, on commercial projects, they do require a crane to lift materials to the roof. And sometimes they also require a piece of equipment called a blower truck. And this is a truck that's specially equipped to blow large amounts of material from one place to another. So traditionally, blower trucks were used to apply mulch to landscape in a very fast manner. And since then, they've been adapted. They're still used for that, but they've also been adapted to blow green roof media, so the actual soil-like substance that you would grow your crops in, to blow this material up to the roof. And it works a lot more quickly than craning the material. And so depending on the logistics of the site and what kind of, you know, the intricacies of your building permit and all this kind of thing, you can figure out if you can save time and money by using a blower truck for your media as opposed to a crane. But you'll still need the crane most likely to bring other materials up to the roof, such as a root barrier or drainage materials, other large items that you can't blow up there.
And what happens at harvest time? I mean, in my mind, I have, you know, I picture these hip urban farmers with, you know, wicker baskets over their arms. But if you have a larger scale operation, you're going to have crates and boxes and maybe need to wash and prep this stuff before you send it to market.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's true. That's absolutely right. And when you're planning out your rooftop farm, you need to think very carefully about where are you going to do this? Where are you going to prep all your produce? Does that happen on the roof itself, where you're taking up space, where you could be actually growing things there? So do you have space maybe within the building or off-site even, where you'll be able to wash everything and prepare it? These are all really important considerations when you're thinking seriously about a rooftop farm. So it's not just let's go up there and grow some vegetables. You have to think about all of these other commercial and sales aspects of the project. What kinds of things are you going to need aside from the growing space itself? And, you know, a lot of these farms also have gathering spaces on the roof because they accommodate tours or school groups. They have special rooftop dinners, benefits, fundraisers, you know, all this kind of thing. So these rooftop farms oftentimes are not just used for production, but they're also used for other purposes that can bring in additional forms of revenue.
We have an email here from Taylor in Austin, Texas, who wants to know, where can I buy rooftop produce?
You know, in Texas, I'm not sure. It seems like a particularly challenging environment down there. But in Philadelphia, New York, places in the Northeast at least, there are supermarkets that do sell rooftop produce. You can also get rooftop produce if you're in a restaurant that grows its own food on the roof. There are certain farmers markets where the rooftop farmers will sell their produce. So it really depends on what city you're in and what's available in that location.
1-800-933-5372, our number. Let's go to Pam in Dallas. Hello, Pam.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. We have a kind of limited time here, so let's get to your question for sure.
Okay. Sure. My question is, my husband is currently putting together a greenhouse in our backyard. It's not on our rooftop, but the reason I'm calling is because he is wanting to utilize the condensate from the air conditioner drain in the summertime to irrigate the, and it is a hydroponic greenhouse, but he does have a pretty sophisticated filtering system on this water. But I just wondered if you'd ever, since, you know, being in a building, I would think that if that was something that was safe to use, that certainly the water from a huge building would be a good source of water supply if it's safe to use.
Interesting question. Thanks, Pam. Do you know anything? Have you heard anything like that used in the past?
Yes. Pam, thank you for the question. You can use condensate like that for irrigation systems. And actually, my company has done that on several projects. We're working on one right now where the client would like to pursue that as well. On these larger buildings, specifically ones that have a lot of climate control, there can be an amazing amount of water that comes out of the HVAC systems, the climate control systems. And that there's no reason why that water can't be utilized to irrigate crops, particularly if you're filtering it. Although you may check and see if you even need to filter it. I'm not sure, but certainly look into that. But that's a great way to reuse water, and it's a great way to integrate the farm with the architecture of the building itself. And there's a lot of other great ways to integrate the farm and the architecture, and people, architects and designers are becoming more creative with that.
Do you find that this trend tends to spread virally, maybe the wrong word, but if a building a block away does this, is you know, my building more likely to consider it?
Oh, I think so. If you see these farms, you want one. And I think that the more there are in a given neighborhood, the more popular they seem to become and the more they spring up. In places like, you know, Brooklyn, they're very popular. Even Greenpoint, which is a neighborhood within Brooklyn, they're even more popular. So they seem to really take off in certain locations as people see them, as people hear about them, as people taste the food. It's really a great thing to do.
Landscape architect Lauren Mandel is a project manager and rooftop agriculture specialist. Her new book is called Eat Up, The Inside Scoop on Rooftop Agriculture. Lauren, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast at kera.org/think. We welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions emailed to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.